Well, I don't want to stand up here and make a speech, but I can.
Get on the table with us.
But I can, I don't have a little thing, so I'll run through some stuff and talk about it, and you guys ask questions. But don't hesitate.
Yeah. Want to see your presentation?
Last time
I have a clicker, but it's in my.
I started, and there was about six or seven people when I started, and I said, "Hey, let's all move to the same table, and we'll just kind of." But there was 20 by the time I ended, so I don't know. So we'll see. We'll see. Obviously, advancement's a big part of what we do, right, as universities. And I know both of you are pastors, so you're used to passing the plate and inspiring people to give. And I know Max has been on the board at Oklahoma Wesleyan for...
For
a couple days.
35 years.
35
wow.
years. Yeah. I was student government president at Oklahoma Wesleyan, and you were on the board when I was student government president. And your brother CB, and yeah. So thank you for serving on the boards. It's a wonderful thing. I will tell you just quickly. This feels kind of self-centered, but a little bit about me. How would you like to learn about me? So I, not too long after I was student government president, and spent some time in Washington D.C. and Capitol Hill, and I ended up getting a Ph.D. in political science, and I was working as a chief development officer at Seattle Pacific University, a good Christian university in Seattle. And the president there and I were close friends, still close friends, preached the message and had a vision for the institution of engaging the culture for the gospel of Christ, and that we as Christians, that's what we ought to do. We ought to get in the culture, be salt and light. And, I could do that probably in higher education. And there's a book called Roaring Lambs that came out about that time. You know that book? It was on that theme, and it was pretty popular at the time, and it was really about the entertainment industry, but it talked about other industries where Christianity had been pushed out, abandoned, just there wasn't a lot of influence of the church anymore, and higher education was certainly one of those. So I embarked on a mission in higher ed leadership of trying to engage the culture of Christ at some really great institutions that are not Christian, even though they had Christian roots. They were not Christian. Trinity University, Santa Clara University, then a couple Cal State universities, the largest Cal State University at Northridge. I was there for a long time. And that's been my journey. And I told folks that and was telling folks that because I wanted you to know that, I'm not just a practitioner of fundraising who's coming in here and giving technique. It's my heart, as with Wesleyan and Christian higher education. And I will write a book someday, maybe, called Simmering Mutton, which is the second chapter of Roaring Lambs. So that's a little bit about my heart and where I came from. And I've taught, I've coached, I've been on Oklahoma Wesleyan's board for a while. I've overseen entrepreneurship programs, a business incubator, performing arts centers, radio stations, and other enterprises at universities. So I've had a chance to look at advancement work from a bunch of different perspectives. So some of what I share hopefully will bring some of that. And I think one of the other things is about philanthropy as context is it's serious business. When someone gives a big chunk of their money, that's a big commitment, one of the bigger commitments they'll ever make in their life. But it's a joyous and wonderful and fun thing to see someone love others through giving their money away, because there's few things that people hold as close as their money. Their family, maybe, the church, of course, their faith, and then money probably is right third on that list for most folks. And the other thing for board members that I mentioned is that you have three hats. You're a board member, your donors and your fundraisers. And as you go through and wear those hats, it's important to remember what your role is. And so the Ben Franklin quote up there he said, there's three things you need to know: where you came from, where you're going, and to whom you must report. He was talking a little bit more theologically, but when it comes to organizations, there's something there too. And The Rock said, know your role, jabroni. So there's that too. yeah, just a little context. Oh my goodness, what just happened? Oh, it got loose. So the morning session, it was about the board's role in oversight of advancement. And these are going to be on a digital, the file, so.
Okay.
If you're, but it was and talking about some policies and how to assess and all that. This is more about how does an institution get good at philanthropy, and what are the building blocks? And those essential ingredients up there are five sort of fundamental things that every school ought to have. Mission, vision, and values, clarity, and support around that. For our institutions, that's pretty strong, pretty clear, much more so than 98% of the universities that are out there. That's not really a concern. It is a concern, but it's you got that. An institutional strategic plan that is reasonable, has a business plan to it, can withstand the scrutiny of business people and people who manage a lot of money or have a lot of money. It's not just, you know, we want to have better STEM programs because that's where the workforce is going, or we want to have Division I sports teams because we think that's a good idea. It's got to be really thoughtful. Why is that important? What's the business plan? What's the budget? How much is it going to cost? How are you going to fund it? Not just through philanthropy, but through, you know, ongoing sustainability. And confidence in leadership. If you've got failed leadership or there's controversy or turnover at the leadership ranks, not just the president, but also board leadership, and the administration in general, if there's uncertainty there, that you're going to have a harder time raising money. Fundraising capacity and competence. It's not good enough to have an eloquent vision and a great goal and great plans and a really good president. You've got to have structure and staff and resources around it to get really good at it. And you have to be intentional. There's a lot of professionalism around that. And I think for smaller colleges, because resources are so strapped, it's hard to get there. But being intentional over time as board members to try and get good at that is a decades-long transformation that will happen if our institutions get better at that.
Is this a key with the development, or are you talking about development officers in that aspect?
Yeah, development officers and the structure of the development office and the programs and everything around it. And some of the support from other areas of campus. So it can't be seen as an isolated enterprise. You've got to have academic leadership involved in it and supportive of it, your coaches, your finance and administration area as well. And of course, president and senior leadership. It has to be seen as an important part of the enterprise, because it is, because it's one of the more sure, more certain investments you can make to really transform an institution. If you're competent and you're investing in philanthropy and development work, you're going to raise more money and more over time, and your endowment will grow. And it is a virtuous cycle going upward and upward. And I talked about in the other session, University of Michigan. They've done 7 campaigns over the last nearly 100 years, about 90 years. And every campaign first one was 50 million, and you see a little blip like this over time. It goes down a little bit after the campaign, but then the next campaign, they go right back, and it's a little higher bump, and on and on and on to where they're doing multi-billion dollar campaigns. They have a gigantic endowment, and it's a huge part of what makes them a really high-quality university. The last ingredient, and a very important ingredient, wealthy people who care about your institution and are at least connected and hopefully inclined to support. There's a lot of great nonprofits around, and even some universities who would, would love to really be good at philanthropy, but there's not a lot of wealth around them, not a lot of involvement or interest or connection to wealth. And so you really have to be thoughtful about building those connections, and know that that's a longer term, thing, but, to be successful in a campaign or in fundraising overall, you gotta have rich people who want to give. It's kind of obvious.
Are you finding a majority of that comes from alumnus, your alumni?
Usually. Now, so Indiana Wesleyan, right? So for both your institutions, you have decent-sized towns around you. They're not huge. Bartlesville's probably got a little more wealth than Marion, but maybe.
Phillipsville.
Yeah,
a little bit old. The top brass, so they moved the headquarters to Houston.
Yeah, so not as much.
So suddenly it made a drastic change where your top people in Phillips lived in Bartlesville.
Yeah, when I was growing up.
Second or third level, right, when you were growing up. In fact, it boasted some of the most, for the size of population, the most millionaires in a community of that size.
When I was a kid in Bartlesville, it was in the top 10 per capita income cities in the country, and top 10 PhDs per capita, because all the research...
Right.
Was there. So there's some wealth around the community. Marion, not so much, but it's large enough. And of course, Indiana Wesleyan's got reach into Indianapolis and elsewhere because of their adult and professional studies programs.
The tragedy there, though, is the old wealth. I mean, it's all old wealth now, and they're dying off or passing on.
Yeah, and the kids don't live there.
The kids, and they don't live there.
Yeah.
So it's beginning to hit us.
Yeah, I bet.
It's tough to.
Yeah.
It's tougher. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a couple essential ingredients. I'm going to get my exercise, jumping up and down. Ooh, ouch. You know, I shocked myself when I touched that. So just real quick on the organization of fundraising.
Yeah.
No, this is much better this way. It's kind of strange when you're dominating in conversation with just three people, but... I did fly all the way out here, so. Annual giving. This is all your direct mail, your digital communications around giving, crowdfunding events, a-thons, whether it's a walk or a run or a phone-a-thon, all those things that are really oriented towards mass communication around giving. And they get a lot of attention. They're very visible. People think about them and talk about them a lot because it's easy to react to them and kind of assess, did that go well? Did it didn't go well? And it's what people kind of know about fundraising. And so it gets talked about a lot. But it's often seen as kind of it's an important driver to philanthropic revenue. It's not. You really have to look at those programs. Those are donor acquisition and participation drivers. And you want to build that base of the pyramid, right? So it's important to do some of that, but you really have to be efficient. And it's where inefficiency abounds because people come up with ideas of stuff to do all the time, and there's no shortage of stuff to do, and it's hard for development staff to tell a trustee or a donor or someone that wants to do this kind of event, or we should add this on, or this, to say, no, we're not going to spend more time and money. We're going to do these things, and that's it. and we're going to do them well, and that's what we think is the best way to acquire and build that base of donors and keep donors giving over time, because that's important. That's a predictor and a lead towards larger gifts. But you just have to be really careful about annual giving and managing it with some precision. Sounds like a storm coming. So there's that. Alumni relations ought to be working really closely with annual giving. I don't think at our institutions we have a sort of a felt separation between the alumni relations activity and fundraising. Some places there's sort of a separation, an alumni relation. We're here to just build connectivity among alumni and create those relationships and have fun and do that. If there is that sense, you have to help your institution get over that, because it really needs to be integrated. And giving has to be a part of all your communications with alumni. You don't have to beat them over the head with asking all the time, but it ought to be a part of the conversation and a natural thing to do. And for alumni, giving is really important, because the percentage of alumni who give, it affects your reputation and your rankings. It adds up to a lot over time. They're more connected to the institution, so it's more likely that they're going to give. And if they're not giving, and if they're not your ambassadors, you're going to have a lot harder time. If they are giving, they're going to be much more connected and involved and give where your treasure is, your heart follows. And so all of that is really important for alumni relations and annual giving and the integration of those programs. Indiana Wesleyan might have a big enough shop that you've got kind of an alumni relations team and an annual giving team, that Oklahoma Wesleyan would probably have the same person doing both, or same people. So, but it's good to have them connected.
In relationship to that, when you are then approaching larger organizations that could contribute, do they look carefully at what the alumni and the current
Some will. And if you have a larger percentage giving, you want to lead with that and talk about that. A lot more will look at the percentage of board members who give. And some will have an explicit funding organizations. Some will have an explicit question that says, what percent of your board gave last year? And any answer other than 100% is the wrong answer.
You say under 100%.
Anything less than 100% is the wrong answer. And in the other session, I talk about board member expectations around giving, and I gave there's a written document that is attached to the PowerPoint that people will be able to have on that. But alumni giving is not the same level of expectation among some funders, but there is some expectation there. But it also just says a lot about your institution. If a lot of alumni are giving, it's a demonstration of satisfaction in the experience. Oh, you know, one of the things about alumni events, I'll just say, you know, there's often a lot of talk about, we want to make it as inexpensive as possible so everybody can attend. And it's good to have some things like that. Your sporting events are, you know, probably don't cost a lot to attend, might be free to attend. And maybe, you know, an annual alumni barbecue or picnic is really low expense. But in general, I wouldn't worry too much about that, because you might have a young alumni threshold and maybe a discount for young alumni. But have high quality events, and the people who can afford to come to them are the people you want to cultivate relationships with. That kind of rubs a little bit against our widow's mite Christian ethos. But when philanthropy, we're not trying to evangelize the folks. That happens in other ways and through the church. We're trying to identify and cultivate, build relationships with people who can make larger gifts. And so don't. I would encourage you to not be as concerned about pricing people out of all your alumni events. That's okay. You may disagree.
So, Stay there. Don't be concerned about pricing them out. Are you saying
have a good event and a good meal and have them pay for it?
And have it not right.
Yeah.
And don't worry about, I know those who will come and be a part.
Yeah. And you're going to have, so I know, so Bartlesville, I bet your annual homecoming, you know, there's all kinds, there ought to be some activities where everybody can come. It doesn't cost a lot. Maybe there's a picnic. Maybe it's around the soccer game or whatever else. But the dinner, you know, if you do a dinner.
Yeah. The first class and put a price on it.
Yeah. Yeah, and just say, look, you know, if we make any proceeds, then we're going to, you know, have it go to such and such. But you want, you know, you it's okay if fewer folks come. They're going to have a good experience. It's, you have to really think carefully about kind of the fallout and whatever kind of upset there is. But if you have a larger menu of alumni engagement opportunities, there should be some higher quality ones. Not everybody has to come to everything. Yeah. I know the Bartlesville setting too well. I can see who would complain.
Yeah, well, because there are those. They're charging $25 a plate.
Yeah, I'm not going. Yeah. Who do they think they are?
And so I was wondering where you were going when you made that statement.
Are yeah.
You? Okay.
So I would tell. So this is Los Angeles, and so it's different, but. We would have our big deal at Cal State Northridge. We'd do a Distinguished Alumni Award banquet every year, and it was a really nice hotel, and I think it cost $400 or $500, you know, to attend. It's $5,000 a table, some people just couldn't come, and that's how we still filled the place up and had, you know, 1,000 people there, and you know, it was a nice event. And we still reach out to the other folks, still communicated to them, still, you know, had things that they could do. But yeah, it's a way of sort of getting closer to the folks and knowing who the folks are that can afford that. It's yeah. So
question about that: when you have that really, you know, high ticket event, is the value of that for that population of donors more about knowing who they are, beginning relationship with them for donation down the road, or having them in this event where you can raise money in this particular event?
More the down the road.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you know, one of the things about events is being really clear about the purpose of the event. Maybe you're having an event that you want to have net revenue from the event. Mm-hmm. You have a golf tournament. Golf tournaments are popular. You have a golf tournament, and your goal is you want to raise $100,000 for scholarships net from that tournament. So you really think about the pricing of each foursome and sponsorships and how much you're going to give away and free golf balls and whatever else or in whatever event. But knowing that that's the purpose of the event. If it's another event and the purpose is, this is about vision casting and inspiration of high net worth individuals. Mm-hmm. You might make it free, but you only invite certain people to that event. So knowing the purpose of the event is really, really important. Major gifts. This is one of those that is kind of invisible, doesn't get a lot of attention until gifts happen, but all of the work that goes into a 6- or 7-figure gift, you know, there's best practices around that. There's effort and diligence over time that's really important. So at Bartlesville, Bob and Joyce Campbell just made a wonderful $4 million gift to that institution, which is one of the larger gifts the school's probably ever had, I would think.
The Drakes did a pretty good job also at local there. But
yeah.
Yeah.
And they've been involved for decades at the institution. And I'm sure that presidents and different folks over the years have worked to reach out to them and made sure they were thanked well for their gift, probably had them to lunch, toured them around, and said, and probably brought them in and said, here's what we're thinking about doing with this. They came to a science building, right? Here's what we'd like to do. I saw that. It was fun driving through the campus and seeing that. Bob and Joyce, I've slept over at their house with their son, Todd. And he's been in my house sleeping sleepovers as kids, so it was fun to see. But it's a long-term relation, and lots of little itty-bitty micro steps along the way. Having intentionality around that, having people, especially at a larger school like Indiana Wesleyan, I'm sure there's people on the development team. Their job is, here's a list of 80 people, and we want you to make sure that they're engaged and feeling good about the university and stewarded, and you want to move towards putting a proposal in front of them for a science building, for an athletics program, whatever it is that they're interested in. And they know those individuals, they understand what they're interested in, and they're concierge service in their relationship with the university, and always facilitating their involvement, and also always thinking about, is this person likely to make a large, do they have the capacity to make a large gift? Are they inclined to make a large gift? Are they given any signs for that? And having conversations that ask questions about that. It's really important, very invisible. Boards don't see that until gifts come in. But it's an important thing. And the other thing about it is, it gets masked and covered over by the annual giving activity, the latest alumni magazine, the flashy digital communication, a nice video, and all that stuff is important. But if you're not being intentional and focused and organized and diligent over time around those 100, 200, 300, 400 people that can make 6- and 7-figure gifts, you're going to lose connection with a lot of folks. Yeah, I'll give you a personal example. So I'm not a major gift prospect for Oklahoma Wesley, and I told Jim that.
He knocked on your door already.
But I'm, you know, but I've done well, and my kids, I'm able to pay for my kids through school, and, you know, another 20 years down the road, if things keep going well and the markets go well, I might be able to make a larger gift to the school. If they had enough development officers, I'd probably get a call every once in a while. I have a kind of a title, and probably the wealth screening data that's out there might say, oh, he might be someone that could do something. If you have enough staff, you know, I would get what's called a discovery call. How you feel about the school? Hey, have you ever come back? And let me tell you about what's happening at the school. And have you thought about joining our president's club at $1,000 a year just to keep me engaged? Now, I live in Los Angeles. Nobody from Bartlesville has the time to come and see me. I'm not a big enough fish. But over time, frankly, if it wasn't for my brother's involvement, I've kind of drifted away from connection to the school. I love it. I care about it. But it's not top of mind. It's probably wasn't in my top five. It moved up a little bit here in the last few weeks, and seeing Jim made me feel guilty about that. But but it's
your
that
dad's, one of the key personnel there for a period of time.
That's right. He was a vice president. So yeah. So, but it happens, right? People just drift. They move on with their life. They have kids. Kids get involved in stuff. And if we're not intentional about keeping connection with the folks that research, word of mouth, referrals from board members, other indications say that person's wealthy and they're getting wealthier, and they're on a track to make a major gift, we should stay connected to them. And you got to be really disciplined, because you could say that about at least 1,000 people who are graduates of Oklahoma Wesleyan, but there's probably a smaller number of that are really inclined and have real high capacity that you have time to spend on. So,
in that, keeping in contact with these individuals, Is it of greater value that the president or someone in that level be the person who does that?
I'm going to talk about the president's role and the vice president's role here in a little bit.
Okay.
president's only got so much time. It's an impossible job. Trustees can play a role there because they're a trustee. Presidential touches can be made efficient. Vice presidents and development officers ought to be able to send, dear Jim, or dear, president, Joe Smith is, a prospect. We think they're really interested in this program. And you've met them at this place. Would you send the following email to them? Dear Joe, I heard you recently made a gift to our basketball program. Thanks so much. Isn't it great to see him doing so well? Go Eagles. And just facilitate so they don't have to think about it. They might just get it cut and paste, boom, and send. And kind of a steady regimen of those kinds of things. A list of thank you calls that they might be able to make while they're driving down the road. All kinds of things to maximize and make as efficient as possible the president's touch, because that is important. People care. The title matters. People remember those calls. But people remember calls from trustees, a former faculty member, a dean maybe, but somebody that is a connection to them that isn't paid to thank them. No. Corporate relations. People, I think, spend a lot of time on this, but I think for both your institutions, really focused sponsorship effort around a program or some kind of activity is probably the best approach. And you heard other speakers talk about this, knowing that the relationships your institutions have with corporations are multifaceted. You can provide educational programs with them. They hire your graduates, and they're members of the same community. So it's a multifaceted. But in that relationship, to be able to say, look, we'd like you to sponsor our alumni weekend. Be the title sponsor at $50,000. Would you be willing to do that? Or a sponsor at this next level or this next level. And foundation relations, if you can find a good grant writer who is sophisticated enough to kind of understand the complex programs of your campus and do the research of finding foundations that are a match and put those proposals together and put the plan together to meet the foundation's requirements, they'll pay for themselves. Those people are hard to find. But intentional foundation like the Kresge Foundation or the Mabee Foundation in Tulsa, the Lyon Foundation. Lilly. Those foundations that, you have to, it's work. It's hard to get a proposal together that's going to meet their standards. And someone's got to write it. Someone's got to pull the information together and make sure it's submitted, make sure there's reports submitted on time, and they respond to all their questions. But there's real money there. It's not vast majority of your philanthropic support is going to come from individuals, but there's ROI and foundation relationships. If you can have at least one person dedicated to that, that's good. They'll more than double their salary and probably three or four times in revenue. So this is the stuff that is really invisible. All the data management research to find out who in your database is wealthy and likely to give, who's been giving consecutive over time, making sure that all those notes that development officers have from their meetings. I met with Joe, and Joe, Joe's really upset about the baseball coach that was fired, and we need to have our athletic director give him a call. Joe, even though he's a biology major, what he really loves are the arts, and him and his wife are on the board of their local art museum, and they, keeping notes and track and all of that data, so important. Because development officers come and go, presidents come and go, vice presidents come and go. Preserving that information and using that database, making sure the addresses are up. I don't even know if Oklahoma Wesleyan has my address. I can't remember the last time I got a magazine. Did they still do a magazine? I got to make sure. See, you know, people lose track, and being diligent about it. And there's best practices out there. You can sweep your database to get most current addresses, and you can sweep your database to get even email addresses and phone numbers nowadays. And also indicators of wealth. It's a little bit expensive to do that, but if I owned a plane, or own more pieces of property, if I was a Security and Exchange Commission insider of a public company, all kinds of things. There's publicly available data that can be swept and identified so that I can have a digital profile that scores me and says, you know, that person is scored pretty high. And, by the way, it looks like from your database they've given 4 out of the last 8 years, and they've bubbled up to deserve your attention. This whole area, it's just so important that you got to be good at it. And it gets neglected. It's, let's have our secretary do it. Or let's, you know, they're the alumni director and they're in charge of this. This is a full-time job. Even, you know, small institutions like ours, Indiana Wesleyan is not small, but I don't know, what about Oklahoma Wesleyan? What do we got, maybe 20,000 alumni at this point?
Something like that.
Yeah. It's 20,000 people. That's a lot of moving parts. And, you know, are they married? Do they have kids? Do they, you know, did they attend any events? You know, did they attend... what are they involved in? Are they wealthy? Are they doing well? Do we have the right address? Constant. And it just takes time. And you got to have a professional adult overseeing it. You can have students help with that, but you have to watch them carefully because those mistakes get made and into the database and it's there forever. So, all right. Every time I touch this thing, I've got so much static, it goes out. Campaigns. So, you know, I mentioned about the University of Michigan and campaigns over time. Being intentional about studying the readiness of your institution to go into a campaign is really important. Do you have the donor prospects research that suggests that you can be successful in a campaign of level X? Do you have, is there affinity for the programs that are going to be featured in that campaign? Or are you finding out that your donors, well, that campaign's all about athletics and scholarships, but your donors are interested in the sciences or theology or these other programs, and how you manage that is really important. The typical life cycle of a campaign is as you study it and as your institution's going through planning, you should be involving who you think are going to be the big stakeholders in those processes. And hopefully some of them will make lead gifts. I'm talking to Jim a little bit. I know the campaign that Oklahoma Wesleyan's in, a $68 million campaign, is pretty early. Well, I bet the conversations with the Campbells started early in the planning phase, and that's a nice big lead gift for that campaign. They'll need several others. But having that lined up and having some of those gifts early on is helpful. When you reach 60%, maybe 70%, there's the public hoopla. So hopefully you can, when you go into the campaign, I don't know when Oklahoma Wesleyan, if this happened, but when you launch a campaign of $68 million, to be able to say, and we already have commitments of $40 million towards our $68 million goal, but we need everybody's help to reach the rest of the way. And we're going to have this big event, and we're going to look at this brochure, and we've got this wonderful video to inspire you, and somebody's going to be in touch with you soon. And, you know, for a couple years, there's the big public phase with a lot of hoopla happening. Ideally, that's how things should go. It doesn't always go that way, but that's how you would hope it would go. And then celebration and commemoration, and make sure that everybody feels good about the campaign. You don't want at the end of the campaign, the board, the staff, the administration, and even your donors thinking, huh, I'm glad that's over with. Let's not do that again. Right? Let's make sure they're happy and repeat it. And good luck. Yeah. This is what a campaign success looks like. So you got your donors up there, and you got your president, and your board. You got other people climbing up there wanting to be a part of the campaign, probably a couple staff members and some faculty members who want to say, hey, I was a part of this success. Everybody wants to be on board, and everybody's happy. And if it's not going well, this is, yeah, see, those kids, they're looking for the vice president for advancement. So, all right, the president. I think you all know, everybody knows, being a president of a university these days is a near impossible job. Unfortunately, our institutions are pretty mission aligned, although there are those sticky, controversial mission alignment questions that do crop up and cause a hoopla and a lot of emotion and challenges. And the president's got to manage all that and manage a complex business enterprise and manage faculty and has multiple bosses of a board. It's not an easy job. But they still have a role to play in fundraising. They've got to make sure that there's a vision and plan that's being put in place that can withstand the scrutiny of serious people. They hopefully can inspire confidence with how they present themselves and present the university. They have to be focused and efficient with their time. The staff has to help them. Board members have to be respectful of that because it is a ridiculous demand. The staff in particular, as well as the board, ought to always be thinking about how do we position our president well. And the staff, especially the advancement staff, development staff, they should see themselves as the palace guard. Mm-hmm. Unfailingly loyal, unfailingly optimistic and supportive and promoting, no matter how rotten the president might be. For the advancement staff, if a president is, you know, failing in such a way that they're fired by the board, it should feel like a surprise to the advancement staff, or they should act like it's a surprise. Oh, wow, we were doing so well. Okay, on to the next one. Let's go. Your development team has to take that seriously. They interact with board members more than most administrators because of the giving aspect, and interact with high level people a lot because of the giving aspect. They have to be absolutely rock solid committed to the success of the president, because of the tie to the institution, within the bounds of morality and law, but more so than any other administrator or any other employee, that development team has to be rock solid behind their president. And just on efficiency, we talked a little bit about staff facilitated actions. You should never have a staff member say to the president, you should send so-and-so a letter. Here's a letter I've drafted. Would you be willing to send to it? Here's what I'm thinking about doing. Do you need there's something about the air in here. I keep getting
that last guy went the wrong way.
I think it's there. prepared organizer.
So, but you know, they have to be as for a staff member to ever say, I don't know, the president, you know, hasn't followed up with them. That's your job. You make sure that that happens, and you make it easy for the president, and not just the president. Facilitated actions by board members or a faculty member that knows a donor or a coach, whatever that right action is, to help advance that donor's relationship with the institution. If it's their old coach reaching out to them, help make that happen.
IT development officers, the ball is always in your court. Even if you've served it up many times the other side, if they're not hitting it, it's still in your court. Make it happen.
No, being that development officer,
though, is not easy. Investing in training, sending them to the Council for Advancement and Support of Education, conferences, and really erring on the side of trying to bring people on that are going to be there for a long term, not stressing them out over annual goals. Say, we want you here to build for the long term health of our institution. You know, advancement folks, you know, there's so much beyond their control and success. There's a lot they can do, but any one year's goal, if the right person passes away, right, or the right windfall, I don't know who the vice president of development is, but because of the Campbell's gift, wow, they're doing a great job, right? They may or may not have had anything to do with it. I'm sure they're doing work around that. But they have to be supported for long-term success. Because they're going to sweat the numbers. And they don't need presidents and boards lording over them. If they have a good plan and they're executing on the plan and it makes sense, just like any other enterprise, results will come. So the vice president, you know, they serve a lot of roles. I think I'll just jump down to bullet four, strategic planner. I find that often, and probably more often than not, the programs that get philanthropic support had a heavy dose of the vice president for advancement bringing the plan together. Presidents, and even more so provosts, and even more so deans, and even more so faculty members, have ill-formed ideas. Good ideas, but not really well-formed. Presidents, a little more sophisticated, provosts, you know, kind of less than...
The level of sophistication behind a plan to move program or initiative forward. And it's often the vice president for advancement who's the one who's saying, okay, well, let's think about this, because they know that the CEO of this company, or the CFO of the company, or this donor who's, you know, worth $100 million, so they've got to have the sophistication to manage that, know what it's about, and live with that world. They know they're going to have tough questions. They know if you put kind of a sloppy plan in front of them, just follow the list of what they need, doesn't have a real budget, doesn't have a plan for financial sustainability, is not going to go very well. So, oftentimes, the vice president is going to be doing a lot of that work.
You know, the other thing I would just call out from there, beware the charming.
So, oftentimes, the best looking person on the president's cabinet is the advancement person. When I was at California State University, we had an advancement council that I chaired. It was all the vice presidents for advancement from across the CSU system, as well as the headquarters people that were involved in the advancement gather every other month, and I chaired that group. And one year we had someone who was a former vice president for business and finance. They'd been in their group
consumer group for years, and that was the first meeting, and he was introducing himself and the parameter, and he said, I got to tell you, you all are much better looking But I say beware of the charming and zoom, because it's easy to say, oh yeah, looking, you know, people like them, they're funny, they're, you know, they present themselves well, they'll do a great job. Maybe not. It's serious work. I mean, you have to be able to write and think and plan and manage budget and think about financial projections and all of those things, which are another level of sophistication. And so,
have a good understanding of the thinking, because I've discovered people who have, unless they just inherited it, most people who have developed a certain amount of wealth are very careful thinkers, planning through what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Whereas, and they want to know what. If they're in that scene.
Yeah, absolutely right.
So we have to have that understanding.
Yeah, people with wealth didn't usually get there with what they've done and didn't plan ahead and didn't make good. Yeah.
Sometimes.
Not very often.
So did you have the list of questions they might ask? Okay, so I talked about the board's role in session one quite a bit, but setting good policy, asking big questions like, how are we assessing our fundraising tactics? Not why did we do that? How do we assess our what's our run rate taking out the quest and the windfall gifts? What does it look like if we take out those two or three gifts in the last 5 years and the two missed the quest? What was our dinner look like without that? They're important to work, to, you know, and there's good things that are happening, but then they'll fit in. But there's a lot more in session one. I'm just going to.
Key Campbell Partners with institutional commitment.
Oh, I pulled mine.
Okay, we're back with our throngs of, there must be 70 people in here that, fundraising requires a lot of help from all over campus. Your finance and accounting office, they're going to help with the back office stuff and providing information that your donors are going to be interested in. Marketing and communications. They're primarily focused on admissions. All our institutions are pretty admissions-driven, but they need to be supporting the advancement enterprise as well. It's a different audience, and even within advancement, those audiences are distinct. Alumni, community members, young alumni, corporations. So that you need help from your marketing office. And understanding the goals of your marketing efforts. Planning and facilities, oftentimes there'll be a, you know, that's an aspect of fundraising, and so they need to be able to have access to the plans and be able to tour buildings and think about, you know, naming opportunities in rooms and for the buildings. Faculty and coaches are big partners. Academic and administrative leadership. You know, they have to be able to give of their time to have conversations with donors. Board members and financial aid and student affairs when it comes to scholarships and student life, you know, to be able to be responsive to your development team when they need input from those folks. Now, a little bit, you asked about what are the right questions. So, one of the things I'm saying about major gifts is there's, you know, people want to know, can they make the ask? How do you make the ask? But I will say there's no magic words. It is in a context of relationship. You can have the most eloquent proposal with beautiful images and really crisp, smart ask with a laser look in your eye that says, will you do this for us, Max? Max, will you do this for us? And you can be really good at that. And it's not going to... It helps, but if it's not in the context of relationship and institutional reputation and everything else that comes with it, it doesn't matter how slick you are. And you can be pretty klutzy if you've got all that other stuff, and good things will still happen. If you're showing genuine love and care about that person and about the mission and trying to align those passions. But any kind of proposal, there's a certain thing. Is your institution credible in doing that? And is the program credible in doing that? If you want an investment in your athletic programs, but their uniforms are sloppy, they don't conduct themselves well on the field of play, they lose a lot, and the coaches are kind of sloppy, you're not going to get a good investment in your athletic program. But if they're crisp and they're sharp and they're doing well, and even if they're not, you know, winning championships, they're really putting a good product on the field of quality, and you can tell that there's real desire to move it forward, and there's an institution around it that's got respect, it's going to go a lot better. So what are those bona fides about the quality of this program and your institution? Mapping out what the opportunity is. Our basketball team to really compete at that next level. We need 3 more scholarships. We need to be able to pay for them to have an international trip every 3 years so we can recruit to that. And we've got to provide our coach with a recruiting budget. What are those things, the specific? How much do they cost? What do they do? Why are they going to make this program meet the vision that we all have for excellence of it? And a budget around that. And then there is that moment where you should say, can you help us with a gift of whatever that number is that you think is right?
Set a number.
Yeah, it's good to set a number. Yeah, and err on the side of high. You can't go higher later. And it's okay if people say, are you crazy? I can't give you that much. We don't know, but this is a big important goal for us. Would an amount of this be more comfortable? Or have you thought about, and this is some of the backup steps, it doesn't have to be all paid today. We could consider paying it over time, but you wait on those backup steps and let the silence sit and then combining it with a planned gift, maybe a lower amount. And then what can you do? How much would you be able to give? You know, 10,000. You know, it shouldn't be a negotiation, and you don't want to embarrass the donor, embarrass yourself. But don't be afraid to over ask because you can't go the other direction.
Just curious question: do you find that there is more success in asking for a donation tied to a specific, whether it's building program, faculty endowment, etc., or a larger donation just tied to the mission and vision of the institution?
The former more than the latter. For your annual giving appeals and lower gifts, to be able to say, you know, support, you know, good old Indiana Wesleyan and help us to continue to change the world. That's always got to be a part of your case. But when you're asking for 6 figures or more, you know, we need, you know, would you be willing to consider a gift of $100,000 to provide 1 new scholarship for a student in perpetuity? Or, you know, whatever that breakdown of a number, would you consider a gift of $50,000 to help provide the cost for renovation of this room? Yeah. And getting those little bite-sized things is not a simple thing. And it's another reason why your vice president for advancement has to work closely with your business office and to think about that. You know, new buildings are great.
Go ahead.
I was saying new buildings are great because you can, you know, you can look at the plan and say, okay, the building's going to cost $10 million. Let's say, look, we need a seed investment of $5 million, and we'd like to put your name on the building and call it something Hall. This room, we'd love to call this the Cole Hall Narthex, or the Gonzalez, I forget your name, I'm sorry.
Turner Bell Adelaide.
The Turner Bell Laboratory. And having a specific amount.
Okay, then what you're saying is what, some years ago, the mission department of the denomination, because they used to just go out and raise funds for missions.
Mm-hmm.
But they came back and started saying, but we need this in Sierra Leone.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or we need this in, like, wherever it was going to be. And they tried to draw it in more because they began to discover people would tie more to this personal thing rather than the general.
Yeah, yeah, they want to know.
Donately, that's been my experience on other boards, yeah.
It's more so, too, these days. People really are getting a lot more exacting with how you're using their money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other thing, if it is, you know, if you are disappointed, which happens quite a bit, it's not, don't be disappointed. So tell me more. Why is this not the right project? How are you feeling about the institution? Is there something that about where we are as an institution that is why you're not giving? Is it the right project? Am I not coming to you at the right time? It's a chance to explore, and you might find out, you know, I just don't care about the sciences. I want our art program to flourish. Oh, really? What's back? You just, it's always an iterative process. You might get the hard no. It's like, I'm just not going to support you, but that's rare. Yeah.
Thank you. Let them feedback rather than. That's what you're doing there. Give them the opportunity to speak into something that may be stirring them.
Yeah.
And making them more, rather than limiting them to it.
I will tell you, so I got an $8 million gift. It started out as a $10 million ask for to support foster youth at California State University Northridge. And we have hundreds and hundreds of foster youth on our campus, or used to. My old campus, they still do. And we knew these people well. I knew them well. They're friends. I still stay in touch with them. The president and I went and told them about the program. I had them tour, meet the people, put a nice proposal together with them, and you know, told them I'd follow up with them in a few days. And I got an email back that just said, Rob, thank you so much, appreciate all your time, but we're not going to be able to do this. So I said, let me come and talk to you. Tell me a little bit more. I said, well, we just can't do $10 million. Oh, okay. Have you thought about maybe spacing it out over time? We could do it over a period of years. Okay. And I kind of thought he'd have thought of that already, but he hadn't. And then I said, and you know, we could make a plan gift component as a part of this, and after they ended up making a $7 million gift that is absolutely transforming the lives of some former foster youth which is actually one of the best gifts I've ever been a part of, because they just they have such a hard life after they're timed out of the system.
You know, I think in terms of what you said, if I remember, I think I talked to Jim maybe in private about that, but the $4 million Campbell gift is actually part of it, even tied to some of their IRAs and all.
Sure.
When their will matures.
Yeah.
That's what my brother used to use.
Yeah.
He was in all that.
That's right, Steve, yeah.
Steve was in banking, plan dress, and he worked with a lot of people whose wills matured.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And so it even tied to that, because
tax consequences even in that aspect.
Yeah.
Bob had a lot of inventions and had stuff he develops in the research center and all that. But
that's
good thinking to think in terms of that.
Yeah. That's all I got, folks.
Oh, well, I think it's been good.
Well, it's nice to get to know you, and nice to see you again.
Good to see you.
Thank you for the personalized presentation.
And sorry, the father.
But our families are long-term family friends.
Wonderful.
Were you born in Kansas City also?
Your brother dedicated me as a baby.
Okay.
C.B. Kolaw was district superintendent up there, I think. Or maybe
he was... Dad was...
Might have been your dad?
Russ was born.
Yeah, your dad. Your dad. Yeah, not your brother. I'm sorry. Your dad. Yeah, it was...
Kansas City
State. Yeah, so he dedicated Russ, and I think he dedicated me because I was born there, too, at St. Joseph's Hospital. Yeah.
But he happened to be at the house... He was staying at the home with your folks when your mother went into labor.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I've intruded upon something then.
We haven't seen each other for 20 years.
Probably.
At least. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you
for coming in and sitting in. So, hopefully something helped in there.